and thank you for standing by. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. All participants will be in a listen-only mode for the duration of the call. During the question and answer session, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one. I would now like to turn the call over to Kathy Harbin. You may begin.
Thank you, Monet, and thank you all for joining us today. There continues to be great interest in this season's influenza outbreak. Today we'll provide the latest FluView numbers and advice on preventing the flu, and also what people can do to reduce the risk of serious illness. CDC Director Dr. Brenda Fitzgerald is unable to be with us this morning, but she has shared an introductory statement, and you will hear that shortly. Following Dr. Fitzgerald's statement, Dr. Dan Jernigan, Director of the Influenza Division in CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, will provide opening remarks and then address your questions.
The flu season is continuing to be challenging, and flu has been intense across the United States. CDC's flu experts will give you details in a moment, but I want to say that I am saddened to tell you that there have been 7 more pediatric deaths reported just this week, a total of 37 so far for this season. The most important things to remember are, 1, protect yourself from flu by washing your hands often, especially if you're caring for someone who is sick. Protect others by staying home, seeing a doctor if you're sick, and covering your mouth when you cough or sneeze. And remember, it's not too late to get a flu shot for yourself and for your child. Thank you.
Okay. I want to let everyone know that we will have a transcript of Dr. Fitzgerald's statement in our transcript. I'm hoping you were able to hear that. But we will have it transcribed in the final transcript. I'll turn the call over now to Dr. Jernigan.
Well, thank you very much. So it has been a tough flu season so far this year. And while flu activity is beginning to go down in some parts of the country, it remains high for most of the U.S., with some areas still rising. Most people with influenza are being infected with the H3N2 influenza virus, and in seasons where H3N2 is the main cause of influenza, we see more cases, more visits to the doctor, more hospitalizations, and more deaths, especially among older people. This season, now, is looking like the 2014-15 season where H3N2 predominated, and that season was categorized as a high-severity season. While most people with flu will feel sick, they may miss work or school, but most will recover. However, some people will go on to have more severe illness, including hospitalizations and deaths. To give you a view of what we're seeing with flu right now, let me just walk through some of the different systems that we have that we use to determine where flu is spreading, how much flu is happening this week, and how severe it is. First, let's talk about the geographic spread of flu. And from that, we know that flu is still happening all over the United States. We've experienced 2 notable characteristics of flu this season. The first is that flu activity became widespread within almost all states and jurisdictions at the same time. The second notable characteristic is that flu activity has now stayed at the same level at the national level for 3 weeks in a row, with 49 states reporting widespread activity each week for 3 weeks. We often see different parts of the country light up at different times, but for the past 3 weeks, the entire country has been experiencing lots of flu all at the same time. If we look at what's happening at doctor's offices and emergency departments, we're clearly seeing a lot of people going in to see the doctor or being seen in urgent care settings. The number of people going in to see a doctor for influenza-like illness increased again this week, rising to 6.6%, and that means that 6.6% of all people coming into the clinics and emergency departments had influenza-like illness. This is the highest level of activity recorded since the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, which peaked at 7.7%. this rapid increase in cases that we've been seeing is after the winter holidays, and it is among all ages, but it's higher among children. So it looks like a big part of the later January activity is flu transmission from kids returning to school. Flu activity has been elevated for 9 consecutive weeks so far this season. And to put that into perspective, the average duration of a flu season in the past 5 seasons has been around 16 weeks, with the longest being 20 weeks. So by that measure, we're about halfway there this season. That means we have several more weeks of flu to go. However, we have some signs that flu activity may have peaked in some parts of the country. California and other states on the West Coast are seeing activity begin to go down. Hospitalizations and deaths, however, may continue to increase as these data are still coming into those systems there. The CDC FluView website has region and state-level data that you can review for more information. Let's now talk about what's happening in hospitals for those patients that are being hospitalized with influenza. We've been tracking the number of people being admitted to the hospital with confirmed influenza infection. And for the week ending January 20th, the rate of hospitalizations are very similar to what we saw in 2014-15, which was, as I said, a high severity season. This week, we're reporting 41.9 per 100,000 as the rate for hospitalizations. The rate is about the same as it was in 2014-15. If you go back to the 2014-15 season, for that whole season, the total amount of hospitalizations was around 710,000. So we would expect at the end of this season to have something probably around that number. We also are seeing some states having much more activity than others, and we collect this information from only a select number of states, but for those we have, we can see that California is around 4 times more hospitalizations than this same time in 2014-15. Minnesota is about 2 times that level, and New York we're beginning to see rises in the amounts of hospitalizations. For California, I think it's important to know that they had at least 5 weeks where they were at a higher level of activity, and so those higher numbers probably reflect having more flu in their community for a longer period of time. The highest hospitalization rates this season, as in most seasons, is among people 65 years and older. It's about the same that we saw in 2014-15, but actually a little bit less than that time. The second most impacted group this season are people that are aged 50 to 64 years of age, where their rate is around 44.2 per 100,000. This represents a change from what we have seen in the last several seasons for 2 reasons. First, during most seasons, young children, those aged 0 to 4 years, have been the next most impacted group after those over age 65. However, this season, people 50 to 64-year-olds are now in that spot. In other words, baby boomers have higher rates than their grandchildren right now. Second, the hospitalization rate for these 50 to 64-year-olds this season is significantly higher than what was observed during recent seasons in 2012-13 and 2014-15. When we look at actually what are those influenza viruses that are sending these 50 to 64-year-olds to the hospital this season, we see that not only is it H3N2, but also the other influenza A virus, H1N1, is contributing to these higher rates. For the younger age groups, the hospitalization rates are either similar to or lower than observed during recent more severe seasons. Let me now talk about what we're seeing from the monitoring of deaths due to pneumonia and influenza in the U.S. right now. And what we see is the number of influenza-associated deaths have risen fairly rapidly. We've been tracking deaths that are due to pneumonia and influenza as they're listed on death certificates. And these pneumonia and influenza deaths went up sharply to 9.1% this week, and they've been elevated for 3 consecutive weeks. For 2 of the recent H3N2 seasons, the 2012-13 and 2014-15 seasons, pneumonia and influenza deaths peaked at around 11 and around 10.8% respectively. So we haven't reached those peaks yet, but it's still early in the season, and so we may be getting to those that level, or maybe even surpass those numbers as the season progresses. As Dr. Fitzgerald mentioned, tragically this week, we are also reporting an additional 7 flu-related pediatric deaths, bringing the total number of flu deaths in children to 37 this season. These deaths are associated with influenza A H3N2, which is the predominant virus, but we're also seeing almost equal numbers of H1N1 viruses and influenza B viruses. It is noteworthy that among the influenza A viruses that have been subtyped in these deaths, about 65.1% of them have been H1N1 viruses. We expect there will be more reports of pediatric deaths, similar to what we've seen in more severe seasons. Just a little bit more about the other viruses that are circulating, the flu viruses. While H3N2 viruses continue to predominate, other flu viruses are contributing to the season. Some states are actually seeing more H1N1 than other states, and we're also hearing reports of influenza B outbreaks in nursing homes, which is less common for this time of year. And while we don't yet have vaccine effectiveness estimates for this season, in previous seasons, vaccine effectiveness against H1N1 and B viruses has typically been in the 50 to 60% range. So in past seasons that are like this one, we have estimated that by the end of the season, 34 million Americans had gotten the flu. Most of these people this season and then feel sick, but they should stay home from work or school, and most will not need to go to see the doctor, and most will recover in a few days. However, some will need to be seen by their doctor or in the emergency department where they may be prescribed antiviral drugs, especially those at high risk. And those that are at high risk that we recommend to get treated if they get sick with the flu are the very young, the very old, the pregnant women, and those with underlying illnesses like heart conditions and lung problems. In addition, otherwise healthy people can have influenza that goes on to more severe illness and can have symptoms like shortness of breath or difficulty breathing, chest pain, very high and persistent fevers or ear pain. Those are the things that should lead the parents or the individual to go and see their doctor where they may be prescribed antiviral drugs. There has been some information out there about antiviral shortages. The CDC is in regular contact with influenza antiviral manufacturers regarding supply and other issues. Some manufacturers are reporting delays in filling orders, and CDC is aware of spot shortages of antiviral drugs specifically for oseltamivir suspension and for generic oseltamivir capsules. Yeah, these are happening in some places where there is high influenza activity. CDC is working with manufacturers to address any existing gaps in the market. I want to remind everyone about our current recommendations. For prevention, CDC is still recommending getting a flu shot. While getting a vaccine earlier in the season is better, there is still a lot of the season to go, and vaccination now could still provide some benefit. There is an influenza vaccine availability tracking system that can help potential buyers to locate vaccines that is still available for purchase. And to do that, folks can go to the CDC website or go to vaccinefinder.org. For treatment, CDC recommends prompt treatment with flu antiviral drugs for people who are very sick with flu symptoms or people who are at high risk for developing serious flu complications when they get the flu. Consider calling your healthcare provider or pharmacist beforehand if you're looking for vaccine or trying to fill an antiviral prescription. Finally, everyone should take everyday precautions preventing the spread of influenza, like washing your hands and covering your cough if you get sick and staying home from work or school to prevent spreading the flu to others. So thanks, and I will be glad to take any questions now.
Thank you, Dr. Jernigan. Monet, we are ready for questions.
Thank you. At this time, we will begin our question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone, unmute your line, and record your first and your last name clearly when prompted. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star 2. One moment as you wait for the first question. One moment. Okay, our first question comes from Helen Brantwell. Your line is open.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my question. I have a couple, if I could, please. Dr. Jernigan, you were talking about the fact that baby boomers are the second most highly affected group this year, the 50 to 64-year-olds. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about why that would be. Do you know what the vaccination rate is in that age demographic? And my second question relates to the fact that, you know, this is a very, very active H3 season on top of a pretty active H3 season last year and then a very active H3 season a couple of years ago. Do you guys have any thoughts about how we could have so much H3 activity in such a short span of time? Wouldn't you think that there would be a fair degree of immunity in the population at this point?
Yeah, so thanks. So with regard to the 50 to 64-year-olds, so the better rates of vaccination, of course, are in those that are healthcare providers, which are up in the 90% range. It's into the 60s or so for those that are over age 65, and then it drops down below that for those that are aged 50 to 64. And so we have seen that that's an area where there's a lot of people, and that those folks are ones that really would benefit from having a higher vaccination coverage. These are folks that are sort of at the peak of their careers a lot of times. They're managing a lot of the businesses, and so them missing flu is something that can impact not only them and their families, but also those that are in the businesses that they work for. The reasons for that aren't exactly clear, but we know in H3 and 2 seasons, we see more of the influenza cases in those over age 50, especially over age 65. But this year, we're actually seeing that I think H1N1 is providing an additional contribution of cases in that 50 to 64-year-old range. In addition, also we're seeing it a little higher in the 18 to 49-year range as well. And so if you look at the percent of influenza A in those over age 65, it's about 90% H3 as the cause of hospitalizations for over age 65. In that 50 to 64-year range, it's about 80%. So there's about twice as much H1N1 proportionately causing disease in the 50 to 64-year-olds. Exactly why that is, there's a lot of different explanations that probably would be better at a different time, but we have seen that the 50 to 64-year-olds and the 18 to 49-year-olds may be a little more susceptible to the H1N1 infection. For the H3 and 2 seasons, so yes, I think the point is that we had a very robust H3 and 2 season last year. It didn't have the concentration of activity like we're seeing this year. It was spread out over a much longer period of time. And the virus that caused it then has had some drift, and we're beginning to see that some, but not a significant drift that would suggest the kind of season we're seeing this year. So it is possible that what we're a number of folks are getting infected that just did not get infected last year, or the virus has had some change that we've not been able to detect yet that's actually causing some of those differences. One thing is also, I think the vaccines just don't do that well against H3 and 2. And so the immunity that was gathered last year may not be enough to prevent having another wave of H3 and 2 this year.
Thank you.
Our next question.
I'm sorry? Okay, our next question comes from Mike Stobe from the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Actually, I think you just answered my question, which was if there's an AH3N2 dominant last year, a season that was intense, and we have it again this year, why is this year so much more intense than last year? I think you kind of got that, but if you have some additional thoughts. Also, I was just curious, Dr. Fitzgerald's recorded message, she sounded a little under the weather. Does Dr. Fitzgerald have the flu?
I think the recording was done in a manner that may not have been the highest level of fidelity. So I cannot comment at all about the illness, but I believe all that you were hearing was a fidelity issue and not an illness issue. Just with regard to the H3N2s, we have had years where H3N2 has had two really significant seasons in a row. 1997, we had one, then 2003-04. So it's not unheard of. And so it's just that we had, since the pandemic, been seeing an H3 year, an H1 year, an H3 year, et cetera. And so this one is not following that same pattern, but the pattern has been seen before.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Rob Stein from NPR. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my question. About the pediatric deaths, that number 37, how does that compare to this, you know, same time previous years? Is that higher than usual? And also, the same goes with the death rate number that you said it increased, I think, to 9.1% this week. Is that, can you provide some context for both those numbers?
Sure. And so actually, after the call, you can also go to the CDC FluView website, where you can get to FluView Interactive. And at that, you can slice and dice the data in many different ways and look at trends over time if you want. But there are some graphs there also that can show that difference very clearly. With regard to pediatric deaths, if you compare what we're seeing this week with the same week that's in the graph in FluView, you'll see that there's fewer this week. But the thing that's important about the deaths that get reported in the United States is that it does take time for them to get to the systems where they're collected. So, for instance, sometimes, tragically, children will die outside of the hospital, and those often have to have a coroner report or a medical examiner report. Those kinds of things will delay the report, and therefore we then backfill the information. So it's really hard to compare what's happening now with the reports with what is printed in past seasons for the same week. Either way, the number of reported deaths that occurred at the end of the season in 2014-15 was 148. So clearly we anticipate that there will be more pediatric deaths this year. We already have some reports that they will be increased next week as well. So with pediatric deaths, these that are in the graph and the ones that we report, again, probably also are an underestimation of the actual deaths that are out there. They may even be as much as twice as the number we have. For the adult curves that we have in the graphs from the pneumonia and influenza mortality reporting system, that data comes from death certificates. And so you can look and see that the rapid rise that we have in this past couple of weeks really looks very similar to what happened in 2014-15. And so with that, it's possible it may go a little above it. It may peak at the same time. We don't know right now. But again, that information has some of the same lags because of information getting into the death certificates as well.
Do you have any total number of deaths, or do you?
We don't, partly because the systems that we collect those numbers from only are representative of parts of the U.S. And so what we do then is look at the rates so that we can have trends over time. In years where there is an H3N2 that is at that higher level of severity, we have estimated that at the end of the year there were 56,000 deaths. So H3N2 years are the ones that have the higher number of deaths, and that upper level is around 56,000 for the total year.
Thank you.
Before we go to the next question, I would just like to address the question about whether or not Dr. Fitzgerald has the flu. She does not. She actually is traveling, and she is on an airplane right now. That is why she was not able to be with us. Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Lena Sun from The Washington Post. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Jernigan. Thanks for taking my call, and you did answer some of the questions. We all had the same sort of instinctive reaction when we heard the news. I was wondering, though, whether this is the highest ILI since the pandemic, but I was wondering also, isn't this the highest activity, that indicator, since 2003, 2004?
Yeah, it just depends on how you want to do the comparisons. The most recent in that system is the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, but a lot of times people will remove that from comparisons because it's so atypical. 2009, the peak was in November and December, so an extremely early peak, lots and lots of children that were getting sick and going into the doctor then, and so that one was about 7.7. You're correct that if you remove the pandemic from the comparisons, then the most recent one would be the 2003-2004 season, which again was one that peaked in late December and peaked at 7.6. So, yes, for seasons, the most recent comparison would be the 2003-04, but in terms of data that we've collected through this system, including the pandemic, it would be since 2009.
Okay. And then just another follow-up. Everybody is interested in the baby boomer part. Do you want to talk a little bit more about you didn't have time in the earlier question, but do you want to address that a little bit more as to why baby boomers seem to be so hard hit? Do you think it's compared to the over 65 that they were less exposed to some of these strains as children?
Yes, I think you're getting at the heart of the issue, which is a very complicated scientific issue. That it's a concept called imprinting, where the first influenza virus that somebody is exposed to as a child has a way of determining how you respond to influenzas the rest of your life. And so, for instance, in 2009, when the H1N1 showed up, that began circulating rapidly, we saw a strikingly low number of people being hospitalized over age 65. And that really reflects the fact that those individuals had been exposed to the H1N1 from back in that first emerged in 1918. So between 1918 to 1947, when that H1N1 was circulating, people that were exposed to that one seemed to respond better when this 2009 H1N1 showed back up. So the same thing may be true in the opposite way, that people that were exposed after 1947 were exposed to H2N2 and H3N2, which are different viruses, and that those exposures may make them a little more likely to have problems with H1N1. So there's still a lot for us to learn about this, but I think it just shows the complicated nature of influenza, that it really depends on a mixture of things, the environment, the virus itself and how it changes, but also the host and the changes that occur as people get exposed to different influenza viruses over time.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Natasha Chin from CNN. Your line is open.
Thank you so much. I wanted to ask a little bit more about H3N2. We're talking about years when this is the dominant strain, that the illnesses and deaths are more significant. Is there something particular about H3N2 that makes it more deadly, or is it simply a result of what people have been exposed to in the past?
No, it's H3N2 definitely is one that has intrinsic features about the virus that does make it more likely to cause severe disease. Exactly what the genetic and antigenic features are that make that happen is actually still being investigated now. That we know that H3 causes worse disease. Exactly why is still somewhat needs to be figured out. H3N2 first showed up 50 years ago, so this is the 50th commemoration this year of the pandemic emerging back in 1968. And since that time, that virus has continued to change. And so it's getting down a path now where it's gone through lots of changes, but it's amazing how much it's able to evade the human immune system still. And also that this particular virus has lower vaccine effectiveness. The exact reasons for that are still being figured out. We do know that when this particular virus that's been around for 50 years is very human adapted. And so if you try to grow it in eggs, the virus ends up changing in ways that makes it look different than what's actually circulating out there. And so those changes, unfortunately, lower the similarity to the circulating viruses, and therefore that might be impacting the vaccine effectiveness. We don't know that for certain, but we are trying to understand if, in fact, having to grow it in eggs is leading to some of the lower vaccine effectiveness. Most of the vaccine that people get given each year is from egg-based manufacturing.
Thank you. And I just wanted to clarify also, we're talking about 9.1%. That number, if you can help clarify what that is exactly and how that's calculated.
Yes. Yeah, so we look at the percent of all deaths that have a death certificate that's listing pneumonia and influenza as a cause of the death, and we put that numerator over the total denominator of all deaths that are reported for that period of time.
Thank you. Okay.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Donald McNeil from New York Times. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. I have two questions. The first was, you went quickly over a number in the middle of what you were saying, Dan, that was 34 million. Was it 34 million Americans have had the flu this year?
No, and it's a risk of putting those numbers out. So in 2014-15, at the end of the season, we were able to take all of the different surveillance information we have and stitch it together and come up with estimates about the burden. And so the point there is that in 2014-15, which was a high severe H3N2 season, there were 34 million people that were estimated to have influenza. There were about 16 million that were estimated to have to go into the doctor's office or to the emergency room, and there were 710,000 hospitalizations that year. So that's an estimate that gives you a sense about where we might end up at the end of this season.
Okay. Do you have any comparison for that number yet this season, where we are on track?
We don't have those estimates. No, we don't have those. Because there's such variation across the season, we actually want to be able to have all of that information so that we can make a better estimate at the end of the year. Your point is a good one, and I think we're looking at ways to have a weekly estimate of some of those numbers because I think it's easier for folks to understand.
Okay, sorry. My second question then. Look, editors keep asking me, is this the worst flu season since? But when did you start tracking flu seasons as accurately as you do now with the ILINET and everything else so that I can say it's the worst flu season since 2003, since 2009, if you don't count the fact that that's a pandemic, or is there a way to accurately say it's the worst flu year since when?
Yeah, so at this point, we don't know what the flu season is going to end up like, so it's hard to say. But it's tracking at the same level as 2014-15, which was the last high-severity season that we had. So this season is
at the same activity level, but there's also the mortality level.
I'm actually talking about in multiple different ways, both activity as well as hospitalizations. And so we look at elements of our system that look at transmission of disease and then elements of the system that can tell us about how bad the season is from a severity standpoint, like hospitalizations.
To go to Lena's question, is it maybe worse than 2014? Is it maybe as bad as 2003, 2004, which would be the earliest year
track? For hospitalizations, the overall rate right now is tracking about the same as the 2014-15 season, except for people that are under age 65. We are seeing more hospitalizations in that group, but the overall amount is about the same as 2014-15. We don't know. I mean, these numbers can change. We may go above the 2014-15 season, and so I think it's a little hard to make some of those comparisons. From an activity standpoint, we're seeing the most influenza-like illness activity since 2009. And for hospitalizations, we're seeing about the same rates that we saw in 2014-15.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. We have time for one more question.
Thank you. Our last question comes from Sarah Toy from the Wall Street Journal. Your line is open.
Thanks for taking my question. So there have been reports about schools closing due to the severity of the flu season. Can you tell us if the CDC is aware of that, if you know how widespread these school closures are and what the vaccination rates are among school-aged children?
Yes. So a couple things there. In terms of school closures, we know that every year schools close, and these are closing of schools not to prevent transmission of flu, but they're usually reactive school closures because the kids have a lot of kids have flu and the teachers are out. So they simply close because they're not able to have school. That happens every year. We know in seasons with H3N2, like this one and last season in 2014-15, we see more of those school closures occur. And CDC does have a system that actually can monitor school closures. I don't have the percentage numbers with me here, but there is a system that we use to monitor school closures around the country. And then in terms of vaccine coverage, essentially the younger you are, the better your vaccine coverage. If you start at the top with kids that are under 18 years of age down to age 13, so this is kids that are 13 to 17 years of age, 46.8%. For those that are 5 to 12 years of age, it's 61.8%. For those that are 2 to 4 years of age, it's 66.8%. And then for the very young, the 6 to 23-month-olds, it's 75.3%. So that's an overall for under age 18 of around 60%.
Can you repeat the figure for kids 13 to 17?
Sure, and sorry for providing detailed numbers on a phone call. But, yeah, so 13 to 17 is 46.8%. And
okay.
All this information is on the CDC website that is FluVaxView. So we have FluView for influenza disease and FluVaxView where you can get any kind of combination of the information for vaccine coverage.
Okay. I just wanted to quickly follow up. At this point, would you be recommending that schools close because of just how the flu is spreading, or do you think that's just not something that they need to be thinking about at this point?
Right. So much of influenza is a very local phenomena, and so the decisions about what happens with schools is going to need to happen at the local level. And so CDC does not have any recommendations for closing schools. And again, school closures in non-pandemic times are usually reactive, where the school has to decide that they have to close because they're not able to provide the services.
Okay.
Thanks very much. Thank you, Dr. Jernigan, for joining us today, and also thank you to the reporters who've joined. If you have follow-up questions, you can call us at 404-639-3286, or you can email us at media@cdc.gov. Thank you for joining us. This concludes our call.
Thank you for your participation in today's conference. All participants may disconnect at this time.